with the COVID-19, we've had to make several adjustments to make sure we're keeping our people safe coming to work, make sure they understand that they're essential to us and essential to themselves, essential to the U.S. as a food supply. So we've done a lot of training, installed a lot of safety stuff. We've put up plexiglass dividers in between our ladies that sit on planters to plant. They sit about 5 feet apart. And we put a plexiglass divider in between those to make sure that we've got that prevention. They wear masks, they wear gloves. We stagger their start times and their break times so the whole crews don't all start up at the same time. And then we also do a lot of educating because we can control what they do here at work. We can't control what they do at home. So we try to educate them as well on, you know, make sure when they go home that they're taking precautions, they're being safe, they're not out socializing in big groups or crowds, and realizing that they have a job here and we're going to do everything we can to help them show up to work. You know, and for them, it's really important because these are mostly seasonal employees. And this is the time they make their money for their families for the year. So they can't afford to be off work either.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Abar Ag Enterprises is a fourth-generation family-run operation that farms processed tomatoes and other commodities near Los Banos in the Central Valley of California. In the history of the Barcelos family operation, it's safe to say they've never faced a year like this one. Aaron is a leader in California agriculture, including chairman of the Tomato Products Wellness Council, and he's our guest today. Aaron, welcome to Farm to Table Talk. So let's get into this and talk about how very different this year is farming from other years.
Things have changed quite a bit with the COVID-19. You know, obviously, it kind of hit us right as we were getting busy with all of our crops. We grow quite a diverse mix from asparagus to plenty of nut crops, trees, almonds, pistachios, pomegranates. We've got some high-density olives planted as well. And of course, processing tomatoes and cotton.
That's a lot of crops.
Yeah, it's a pretty diverse mix, but it's kind of what we're kind of trying to move away from the row crops with the economics of farming in California these days. They're having a hard time paying the bills, so we're trying to move towards high value crops and also try to spread our water risk. So that's some of the reasons behind that.
You know, if we did a 30-second history, Aaron, how many years has your family been farming around Los Banos?
I am a fourth-generation, more of a first-generation farmer, but a fourth-generation in the ag business. My dad, my grandfather, and my great-grandfather all had dairies. They were in the dairy business. And when my brother and I got out of college in 1987, my dad was getting out of the dairy business at that time, and of course, I had an ag business degree and almost completed a dairy science minor, thinking we were going to come back to the dairy, and those plans changed, and we had about 800 acres of ground that we were farming primarily as feed stuff for the dairy, and my brother and I just started farming that. And so we've kind of evolved over the past 30 years and to a 7,500 acre operation of a pretty diverse mix, like I just mentioned.
You know, your family was ahead of the schedule. I mean, it's been a difficult time for the dairy industry, and I see the news around the country, and they say that there's been dairy farmers quitting at the rate of two a day in Wisconsin. And in California, everybody had to get bigger. Your family evidently saw the writing on the wall and saw other ways to go in agriculture.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. You know, that was my dad's decision. I was completely taken by surprise when it happened. But yeah, looking back, I think it's been the right decision for us. That's for sure. We've thought about getting back in the dairy business because, you know, when you grow up with cows, they're kind of always in your blood. But we never made that leap, and pretty thankful for it today, to be honest with you.
Yeah. It's so if you look at a decision, then you've got your farm. And there are several family members involved now in your farming operation, right?
Yeah, so I farm with my brother and my nephew right now. We're all partners in Abar Ag Enterprises. I've done a lot of succession planning over the last 5-6 years. My dad passed away in 2017, and he was an active partner until then. But we've had a plan for that. And then also plan for my brother's son, Jake, my nephew, coming into the business. And then my son, Alec, just graduated from college in December. And he is now working and, you know, making all the steps that we have in our succession plan to allow him to be a partner.
So was it at the end of a year, like last, November, December, or earlier, are you making plans for what you're going to do with all of your farmland? And you don't have many decisions to make about the ones you get planted into trees, because they're going to be trees. But the other, the row crops, you're making a decision as to what's going to fit and what you can can market profitably?
We're making those decisions now for next year, to be honest with you, on open ground. And what we're hampered by is our lack of water uncertainty. So it's really hard to plan for next year, let alone 3 or 5 years out, which we'd like to do. So our permanent crops are obviously based on long-term planning. But the water around that and how to support those crops and make sure we have enough water to grow those crops every year, that's why we've got so many open acres as well, because we've got to have that as insurance for these drought years like now, where we've got a 15% allocation. So obviously we've got, we had plans growing 2,500 acres of Pima cotton this year. And we are going to cut that back to about 1,000, because we're going to fallow those acres to have enough water to source for our processing tomatoes and all of our permanent crops. So I may have a plan in place, and we probably change that crop plan for next year 3 or 4 times at least before we actually get into it, depending on water allocations, pricing, crop pricing, things like that.
You're making sure you're keeping enough water for the trees. With almonds, and
So we have almonds, and we have pistachios and pomegranate trees. And then we also just started planting high-density olives. We've got about 1,000 acres of almond trees in the ground, young trees, 600 of pistachios, and 350 of olives, 300 of pomegranates. And we've gone to the olives and the pistachios a little bit now to kind of diversify our water mix a little bit. And the almonds, you have to put water on every year. The pistachios and the olives can take a little more stress and not need as much water as the almonds every year. So in the low allocation years, we can short those a little bit and not permanently damage the crop like we would in almonds.
So then the part you have left that's open ground, you were starting to say that you're going to fallow some land just in anticipation of needing the water to keep the trees and your other crops like your tomatoes adequately irrigated.
Yes, that's correct.
Since you're not relying on just when it rains, you've got some idea of you right now about what your allocations are probably going to look like in the coming year?
So we've been allocated 15% on the federal project, which is the San Luis project, where we take a lot of our majority of the ground we farm is in federal land holdings, federal water districts. And then we still have some, we farm in 5 different water districts, so it gets a little complex. 2 of them are original river rights districts, part of the exchange districts. So we have a pretty good supply there year after year. And we can use that to supplement a little bit in our federal side as far as water transfers. But it's really complex when you put the 5 districts together and in water. And then also with Sigma now, it's another unknown for us, because we're not sure how it's going to help some of the wells that we've used in the past to help supplement our surface supplies in short years. There's a lot of uncertainty and unknown on water supply going forward for us.
I mean, I've been around here a lot of years, and I have a hard time figuring out water policy yet. I mean, we've been talking about 15% of what and so forth, but Sigma is another whole thing. Could you explain that?
Yeah, let me touch on water policy real first, though. But so the 15%, to give you an idea, most federal water districts are allocated 2.2 acre feet of water per acre a year. That's 100% allocation.
Right.
We haven't got 100% allocation in several years. So take 15% of 2.2, and that's what a 15% would be. And to put that in further perspective, an almond crop will take 4 acre feet of water. So you already go in 2 feet short on what you need if you get 100% supply. Sigma is pretty complex. There's a lot of uncertainty in it, because there's just not enough good science and data to support underground water movement and storage, and what is really a sustainable factor, because it's going to differ in each basin and each sub-basin, depending on inflows and outflows and surface water supplies, especially because surface water supplies are what you're going to need to charge for every foot of water that you withdraw out of the ground, you've got to put 1 foot of water back into it somehow. And you've got to show those exchanges going forward. And that's to be fully implied by like 2040 with some, you know, you may have a year where you draw a little bit more than you should. And then other years you put more back in to make up for it within the time frame.
How do they track that? They didn't want to suck all the water out of the ground.
You have natural inflows coming off the Sierras and the foothills as well, that and right. rivers that run through that have some that add water too. So there's a lot of factors that go into it, Roger. And it, as I said, it's complex. The data isn't good enough. Going forward, I mean, there's a lot of groundwater monitoring wells that are going in. There's going to be every well that's going to be pumping water will have a meter on it, I'm sure, of some sort, and we'll be tracking that throughout the state. All the individual GSAs and will be, you know, charged with tracking that and doing all the monitoring. And the other big factor that a lot of people realize, but some don't, is subsidence is probably the number one issue that we have that will affect our groundwater pumping. So areas that are subject to subsidence from overdrafting are areas that are probably going to be shut off first from pumping. And I could see that being the first thing that comes down the road. All these plans are supposed to be enforced by 2022. They have to approve all those plans. And then once they're approved, we've got to start enforcing them. And then every 5 years, we update our plan to make sure that we're moving towards sustainability by 2040 is the goal.
And I would have to think that a lot of people think that there must have been a simpler, more fair way to do these things, but this is what you're dealing with.
So yeah, a lot of the times, you know, as active as we are in farm groups, farm organizations, we still end up pretty much dealing with what gets handed down to us. And so that's just the regulatory climate of California, just another one of the challenges that we have in ag to stay successful.
So when you're looking at a year, you've got all these, you got the trees we've already talked about, you've got the water policy, you've got to leave some land fallow that you're not planting anything, so you've got some flexibility to deal with your water. And then you're making crop decisions of these other row crops. I assume one of the biggest of those row crops is what you're doing with processed tomatoes.
Yeah, so the processed tomato thing, you know, we've been tomato growers, one of the first crops that we started growing back in the early 90s. And so we've grown processing tomatoes for 30 years now. And it's been, you know, over the years, it's been a pretty consistent crop for us. We consider ourselves tomato growers, but the last 3-4 years have been really challenging. It's been tough for the whole industry. There's been no export market at all out of California just because of the high dollar, the high value of the dollar. So we're not competitive overseas. And then you tack on our high cost structure, our high prices that we're now, you know, between labor, regulatory stuff, water issues, you name it, seed. It's just gotten to a place where unless you hit your tonnage every year, the return on investment is really poor. So we're looking at this year hoping that, you know, part of the COVID-19 thing is one thing we see as growers, we see that you go to the store and there's no tomato products anymore on the shelves, right? Who'd ever thought you'd never see pasta sauces and pasta and salsas and things like that, but they're not there. So we're hoping the demand's picked up on the retail side, which it definitely has, and that'll create more demand for the product we're growing in the field. But you know, then you get back into COVID-19 issues and we're planting today tomato fields and, just having our fingers crossed that by the time we get to August and September, when we're harvesting these crops, that you know we're still in a world where processors are up and running and able to take our fruit because it's a perishable crop. And if they can't take it, that gets disbanded, or we're probably going to be in a world of hurt.
You look at the concerns that are happening during COVID-19. The meat processing plants are having terrible problems. It is pretty hard to figure out how you can process meat without having a whole lot of people on the floor, and they're almost elbow to elbow. And so you've had all of these issues where plants have been closed down. On the other hand, the positive with tomatoes, it's pretty well automated. I mean, from the field, there's hardly anybody touching the product into the trucks, and as it's going through the plants and so forth, there aren't a lot of humans involved in getting the process along. I'm hard-pressed to think of any food that's much more automated than processed tomatoes are.
Yeah, I would say you're probably right on that track. There, I mean, as far as a commodity, you're absolutely right on the processing side where it isn't handled very much. I mean, we mechanically harvest, we dump it into a trailer, it gets shipped to the plant. The plant runs it pretty much automated throughout, depending on what the product is. But so we're somewhat insulated, I guess, against things like a meat plant would have or something that's more hands-on.
One place you are hands-on is getting them planted. Tell me what that's like.
Well, usually, you know, we're running transplant crews, and we'll run about 25 people in our transplanting crews. We're still doing that, but with the COVID-19, we've had to make several adjustments to make sure we're keeping our people safe, make sure they feel safe. That's probably the most important thing, coming to work, make sure they understand that they're essential to us and essential to themselves, essential to the U.S. as a food supply. So we've done a lot of trainings. We've done a lot of safety stuff. We put up plexiglass dividers in between our ladies that sit on planters to plant. They sit about 5 feet apart. And we put a plexiglass divider in between those to make sure that we've got that prevention. They wear masks. They wear gloves. We stagger their start times and their break times so the whole crews don't all start up at the same time, that they're not. And then we also do a lot of educating, because we can control what they do here at work. We can't control what they do at home. So we try to educate them as well on, you know, make sure when they go home that they're taking precautions, they're being safe, they're not out socializing in big groups or crowds, and realizing that they have a job here, and we're going to do everything we can to help them show up to work. And for them, it's really important, because this is the time, these are mostly seasonal employees, and this is the time they make their money for their families for the year. So they can't afford to be off work either. So we're doing everything we can to try to do that. We've had several safety meetings. And I'll tell you, when the COVID-19 really started getting serious in California at the end of March, it felt like for 2 weeks, every day was a Monday morning after a long holiday on the ranch, because it was just changing. Everything was changing so fast and so rapidly with, you know, as we got more information on keeping people safe and how to do it. And then, of course, you know, we had so much unknown, so much fear amongst our own workforce, just making sure that we gave them the best information we could and keep them educated was quite a challenge. It was kind of an on every day updating it and just going with what we knew and making the best decisions we could.
I really had never thought about how you had to be concerned about what they do when they're not at the farm. It does make sense that if they get home or they're in a situation that's crowded and they're not careful, they're much more likely to get infected.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been new to all of us. We're all adapting as fast as we can. And we also realize that, you know, we can't afford to have someone in one of our crews get sick, because, you know, if they expose the rest of our crews and then all of a sudden we're searching for people, well, we're not going to get that crop planted right now. And our year was shot. So especially with processing tomatoes, because we have these delivery schedules that we're supposed to deliver into the processors, which requires us to plant our fields in a certain order at a certain time. And if we miss that window to plant, then you're just not going to plant that field for the year.
You know, you got several crops. Are all of the processors taking the crops that they said they were going to? Are they, do you look to them fulfilling their commitments?
On the tomato side so far, yes. I think we're fortunate. We're in an area where we're close to a lot of processors. I delivered to four different processors. And like I said, we've had long-term relationships with most of them. So we haven't been cut back. They want all the tomatoes we're going to grow this year. And I think processors are looking to the future and hoping that the demand that is out there in the retail side is going to help improve their markets as well this year. So I think we're all hopeful going into the year as far as expectations on it, with all the uncertainty that goes along with it. But that's part of farming as well. There's a lot of uncertainty and risk that goes with farming that you can't control. Asparagus industry has been hit really hard the last several years just because we can't compete with the imports coming from Mexico on that market. So most of the asparagus that was traditionally grown in the Delta, the Stockton area, is pretty much gone now. Our shed that we're partners with Turlock Fruit in, we probably are the largest grower of California asparagus there is left. But it's been really challenging on that front, because first off, you know, all through March, there was so much asparagus coming in. And when the COVID-19 scares hit, there was just no market for it, no export market, and tons of asparagus on it. And the price was the lowest I've ever seen it. Traditional 28 pound box of asparagus will sell at that time of year in the mid 30s. And it was $10-$12 a box. And so we're out there with all our costs, cutting boxes, not knowing what's going on, just trying to keep our market or stay in the market as long as we could, and losing money every day doing it. And then we've got 125 people out in the field every day cutting asparagus. Same with the tomato crews, you know, educating those people, staggering start times, making sure that we're doing all the safety things that we can for them not to get sick. Because asparagus is, if you don't harvest it, you lose it. And if we stopped harvesting, we'd pretty much be done harvesting for the year. It's challenging. It's a fresh crop. It's very perishable. If you don't cut it today, then it's tomorrow it won't be any good. You'll be throwing it away.
You mentioned before that the cost of labor is, you know, has been going up. But on the other hand, you're getting more and more competitive with what you've been paying workers. And I understand, like, the big difference to asparagus is that it's so, labor is so cheap in Mexico. That's mostly how they've ended up getting business away from California, because the labor.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the biggest denominator. Mexico can probably ship a box of asparagus into the United States into California for $16, $18 a box. It costs us 32 to 36 just to get that same box out the door of the shed in California. So, you know, we're twice as high, if not two-thirds as high as a Mexico box as far as our produce costs.
Well, and I know you get back to the other commodities like tomatoes. A lot of the tomatoes that are processed and even Italy, I understand, are coming from China. And I mean, these just raise all kinds of questions for consumers that should be curious of where their food is grown.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we talk about food security, and I think maybe with what's going on in the world today, that becomes more of a prevalent issue. I hope it does. I hope people want to put more stock on that. There's a lot of buzzwords out there about sustainability and locally grown, carbon footprints, things like that, that at the end of the day, most produce buyers and most stores are buying on price. That's the number one factor. And, you know, America and California, especially, we are never going to be the low cost provider on a specialty product just because of the regulatory climate we live in, the wages we pay, those type of things. Some demographic, some part of society is willing to pay those prices going forward. I hope there's more, to be honest with you. It's pretty interesting when you think about what the average American consumer pays for their food product. And it's, I think it's less than 15% of their total annual income these days. And you look at other parts of the world that are quite a bit higher than that. The world is flat to a degree, but maybe not so flat today as it was previously.
I'm always preaching, I think people should pay attention to where their food is grown. It's understandable there's some things available, like seasons, that it's coming from different countries because it's not our season. Then just know something about it, because not all production systems are the same.
Agreed. Especially when you walk into a produce aisle and you take a look where that produce is coming from. A lot of these varieties that are coming in from Central America and other places, you know, they're made to hold in the store. And yes, you might get a cantaloupe in December or something like that, but the flavor profile is just so much different than something that's in season and what comes from a regular California variety, for sure. And you can tell it on the asparagus even. You know, now that we grow asparagus, I mean, I usually don't eat asparagus unless it's during season here, just because the freshness is completely different. If you buy a California bunch of asparagus in the store, I guarantee you it's going to be a lot fresher than something coming from Mexico, just because of how many days that Mexican product had to travel and sit to get here and get on that shelf, which is what's happening in California.
So Aaron, when you're in the busy season, how many families are dependent on the income from your farm?
Well, this last payroll, we had over 200 employees, so a little over 200 employees. So how many families is that? It's probably 150 or more, because we do have a few siblings working for us and that type of thing.
So it's a big responsibility. You're looking through the season as you're looking at finishing the season, again, with the pandemic, the reaction to the COVID-19. As you look ahead to harvest, what are the areas that you're particularly paying attention to right now? What are the issues that keep you awake at night?
Well, the number one issue that kept me awake at night for the last month has really been just the employees that we have. You know, we were pretty family oriented here. We've got many employees that have worked for us for 10 years or more, some 20, you know, some generational now, where we've got their children working for us as well. So keeping all of them with the job was very important to us. Not having to lay anybody off was very important to us. And so we're taking some risk planting crops like Pima cotton. We're planting Pima cotton this year. The Pima market is absolutely terrible. You cannot sell a bale of Pima right now if you wanted to. There's no demand on the retail side. Mills are canceling orders all over the world. Cotton is flat out terrible. There's so that thing looks really, really bad. But we're gonna plan it because that's, you know, part of what we do, and we're gonna hope that things turn around on the retail side sooner than later. But there's a lot of risk involved with that. That's been keeping me awake. The stress of just, you know, making sure we don't get people sick, family wise, employee wise, all that has been keeping me awake. And obviously, I run the business side of things for our operation, and so the financial side has definitely been keeping me awake. We struggled with the payroll protection program for quite a while, trying to figure that out, get our applications in, trying to find banks that would be able to do it. Our regular farm credit lender wasn't able to do it at first because they didn't have a relationship with the Small Business Administration. They finally were able to at the end, and we did get our application in right at the end, which took a little bit of pressure off of us, for sure. So that part's been helpful, but stressful in the same.
Well, it's interesting with all of the bad news and the challenges. There are some surprises, like you were saying, that the fact that stores are kind of running out of salsa and tomato paste and people eating more pizzas. And so the food service side is bad, but the retail side's looking good. And nobody saw this coming.
Absolutely. And you know, we will adapt. It's going to take us a little longer on the food service side to adapt into more of a retail market. Everybody's working really hard to that goal because it's really sad when you see the food bank, all that type of stuff, and the people that need help. And we've got crops in the field that we can't afford to harvest because there's no place to take them or no infrastructure to get them there. That to me is kind of one of the real eye openers for us as an industry as we go forward.
There's a lot on your mind continually, but I'm curious, in all of this environment, what are you the most hopeful about in the future in farming?
Well, first, let me say, I think we're thankful that we get to come to work every day here, be outdoors. You know, there's risk involved with it, but I couldn't imagine having to shelter in place in a small area now and not be able to get out of my house. You know, we're used to being outdoors as a farm. I think as a farmer, I'm thankful that we can still do that and still provide for a nation. So that's been rewarding. As far as, you know, the challenges of going forward and looking forward to what we do, I mean, you're right about the planning. I mean, we're always trying to think through where are we going to be as an ag industry in California 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, and how do we plan to get there to make sure that we're still profitable and still surviving. The one thing I had a good friend tell me this way back when I first started out farming, and he said the challenges create opportunities. And that's kind of where we're at now. These challenges that we have today is where are the opportunities in that for us? You know, how do we see through that and plan for the future, like you say? So we're looking for opportunities. A lot of times in history, tough times create better times. Markets get better, demands get better. And the key is to survive the tough times. And so we're going to work through our way to survive what we have going on now and hopefully come out on the right side of this on the other end, Roger.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.